An unpublished federal report appears to undermine the belief that commercially available ethanol-blended fuel produces cleaner emissions than regular gasoline. The study found no statistical difference between the greenhouse gas emissions of regular unleaded fuel and 10% ethanol-blended fuel. Ethanol is far from a cure-all for the nation's energy problems. It's not environmentally friendly, as some supporters claim, and would supply only 12% of U.S. motoring fuel, even if every acre of corn were used. As we continue to pump ethanol into our cars to the tune of $4 a gallon or more, reservations continue to arise about corn-based ethanol, the second-generation biofuel. What progress can we report on the development of the next biofuel, and what are the prospects of developing a biofuel that doesn't have serious drawbacks? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
U.S. energy policy is in a state of what may be called urgent confusion right now, and a kind of a horse race is in progress to see who comes up with the most practical biofuel. Who's likely to win that race, and how soon might that new fuel affect our daily lives? Our guest has a front row seat for that horse race. He's Timothy Donahue, a professor of bacteriology and the lead scientist at the UW-Madison-based Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center.
Welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start, first of all, with a definition of biofuel and then some sense of how important this issue is.
One useful definition of a biofuel is something that is generated from a biologically relevant source. So in today's society, the two major biofuels that people are talking about are ethanol or so-called biodiesel, which comes from soybean or other types of agricultural products.
But it could be any – I mean, bio just means something living, right?
It's biological basis. So tomorrow's technology, we could be talking about sourcing fuels that are biologically based coming from animal waste on a farm, or waste products from food processing, or plant biomass, the cellulosic parts of – the non-edible parts of a plant.
And how important is the question of finding alternative sources of energy right now?
I think it's critical. I think we have exhausted a fraction of the fossil fuel resource on this planet in 100 years that took millions of years to generate. So we cannot continue to go at – this business in the way that we have indefinitely. There are parts of the globe that are ramping up their industrial activity in the Pacific Rim and elsewhere that are going to be increasing consumers of fossil-based fuels unless we find alternatives. The cost for getting fossil fuels out of the ground is increasing every day. The other resources that are out there, they are significant ones, have all sorts of other costs and environmental impacts associated with them. So I think it is timely and critical for us as a nation and a society to think about diversifying how we generate energy that's part of our energy grid. The center that we're in at Madison is mostly focused on the part of the energy grid that goes into our gas tank, transportation fuels. But I think the idea of diversifying the energy grid from homeowner use, from lighting cities, from running farm equipment and heating our homes and transportation fuels is really relevant. And there's going to be an opportunity to use biofuels in some of those venues very well. And there's going to be opportunities to use wind, solar, and other technologies in other parts of the energy grid.
Well, we got, what, a million years or so out of the first generation of biofuels, which is just wood, burning wood. And now suddenly that loop has shortened considerably because we talk about corn-based ethanol as the second biofuel, and that's been around, I don't know, in practical use for 10 or 15 years, and already we're seeing a downside to it.
Let's remember how we got where we are. You're right that we've actually lived for millions of years on this planet, probably with burning wood going back to the cavemen, if you will. And in Wisconsin, we still generate heat in some times of the year by doing that. So that's a biologically based fuel. The current technology blending gasolines with ethanol, I think, started in the 70s, not for the reasons that we're talking about increasing ethanol in fuel today, but because its use was going to help us control carbon emissions in the atmosphere. So it was done for environmental reasons. And what's happened over those 20 or 30 years since we've been doing that is the amount of ethanol that we've been putting into our fuels in certain states and in certain parts of the world is going up all the way to 85% of the fuel in Brazil. But the way that we're generating that ethanol has not really changed to take advantage of the quantity of ethanol we need to sustain that activity. So there's been a disconnect in research and development and implementation of how we were going to mix other additives into fuel, ethanol in particular, because we know how to make it, that's led to the situation that we're in today.
And why does ethanol have such a bad reputation, that some of those quotations that Norman started with? What's the downside?
A big downside, depending on how you do the analysis, there are a variety of perceived downsides or real downsides. I would say real downsides are the following. As we have continued to ramp up the addition of ethanol into fuels, we have not figured out how to produce it more efficiently and more responsibly. So we have begun, because of that, we have begun to devote more and more acreage of land globally into the production of sugar or starch-based ethanol. In the U.S., it's starch-based because we're talking about taking the starch out of corn kernels, converting it into sugars, and then fermenting it into ethanol. In Brazil and in tropical areas, the feedstock for ethanol production is the sugar right out of the sugar cane. So they skip a step by not having to convert starch into sugar. So although we've increased the amount of corn we can get per acre in the U.S. over this period, the demand for ethanol is outstripped that increase of corn per acre. So we've needed to invest more acres into corn. And that's led to a significant number of environmental, social, and economic questions that have come up. Environmentally, corn in the U.S. is a very intensive farming practice. It requires a lot of fertilizer, which increased the cost. It has environmental impacts associated with that in terms of air and water quality, nitrates in the soil, which then get converted to nitrous oxide that goes into the atmosphere. And that's actually a worse greenhouse gas than the CO2. It's led to changes in land use in the U.S. A lot of marginal land that wasn't being farmed is now being put into production, and that does not go without environmental impacts. It's led to the shifting of the acreage that's in one type of crop compared to another. If a farmer can generate so much per acre for corn and so much per acre for soybean, from a business decision, it makes sense to shift the fraction of the acreage that's being put in that. So there have been a lot of issues that are associated with the ramp up in corn-based ethanol in the U.S. that have led to what I think are very significant and legitimate discussions about how much longer we can sustain this and how much further we can continue down this road without a major shift in how we do things.
Regarding corn-based ethanol, the impact that it has on the environment, is it indeed cleaner than gasoline?
What it's doing is it's taking carbon out of the atmosphere in this summer and burning it back into the atmosphere in the winter of 2009, by the time the sugar gets converted into a fuel and that fuel gets to my gas tank, let's say. So it is recycling what we call young carbon. So although it's putting carbon into the atmosphere, in the winter of 2009, it's using carbon that was in the atmosphere in the summer of 2008. So it's a turnover. Now, fossil fuels are releasing carbon that's been buried under the surface of the Earth for millions and millions of years. And when that gets burned, it's putting carbon into the atmosphere that hasn't been there since 2 million years ago. So that's where we're getting a release of more carbon into the atmosphere, because we're taking carbon that's been hidden under the ground and now putting it in the atmosphere because we're burning it. So it is not fair to say that corn-based ethanol is a carbon problem, because it's really recycling it. It's the mixture of old carbon and new carbon that is generating the increased carbon in the atmosphere.
So how does a really efficient, environmentally friendly corn-based ethanol plant work? What is the cycle? I mean, is it possible to really minimize the amount of waste by recycling everything you got?
So, you know, operationally, what they do is they take the corn kernels and they take the starch that's in there. Now, we all buy starch when we buy Karo syrup or something. Maybe I shouldn't mention names, but we buy corn starch. And they take that starch, and by a very simple old process, they convert that starch, which is a polymer, down into its composite sugars. And they then take those sugars and they essentially ferment it. So it's existing technology that's been around for a long time. And it's technology that we're very good at in Wisconsin, especially when it comes to the fermentation of sugars into ethanol. That's essentially what a brewing company does, and we're really good at that without mentioning names in the state of Wisconsin. But regardless of what type of ethanol-based fluid you're making, it's taking that sugar and making ethanol out of it. Then the next step is, since ethanol dissolves in water, in order to use ethanol in gasoline, you've got to remove it from the water and get it purified. Unlike other fermentations where we tend to drink ethanol mixed in with the residuals, you can't put a glass of wine or a bottle of beer in your gas tank. You've got to remove the ethanol. So there are energy and environmental costs associated with every one of those steps. That's cracking the starch into the sugars, that's taking the sugars, fermenting it into ethanol, and then purifying the ethanol out. And there's going to be residuals along all of those steps. The residuals from the fermentation are essentially dried down and put back in the food chain as animal feed.
Okay. So if you had a herd of cattle next to your ethanol plant and you're growing corn, you're feeding corn to the ethanol plant and the residuals to the cattle, and then maybe using the cattle byproducts somehow else in your ethanol plant, you can get a loop that's pretty efficient?
That's right. There are breweries in California and elsewhere, little microbreweries that essentially do exactly that. They make beer and they take all their residuals and they use it to feed animals, and then they have a restaurant and those animals are then, you know, part of what they use. Now, that does not happen in Milwaukee, to my knowledge, but it does happen in other more closed and sustainable types of activities.
Well, let me ask you about that ethanol then. Once it is produced, if I put it in my gas tank and I'm driving to Vermont to visit my daughter, how is the performance of my car going to be different using the ethanol as opposed to regular gas? In other words, how much more efficient? Is it going to drive as well? How does it stack up?
I think we've been doing it for decades. It stacks up quite well. The mileage per gallon difference might be a couple of a percent less. But again, as a society, remember, we did this because we didn't want the carbon emissions from running on pure petroleum-based products. So there's a trade-off with every decision, and that's one of the trade-offs. Is do we want more particulates and more health problems with running on pure gasoline than we have with having more of a greenhouse effect, because those particulates live in the environment and last longer and have a more of a negative effect on the atmosphere and the ozone layer than the CO2 that comes out of burning the ethanol.
So miles per gallon with ethanol might be maybe a little more than it would be with a pure petroleum-based product, but still
it's cleaner by far. Yeah, that's right. In terms of that's exactly why we got into the ethanol business before. Now there's a different set of issues on the table that are driving us to ethanol than we had in the old days. There's issues of energy security. There's issues of environmental issues. There's energy independence. There's issues of trying to plan for the day when the cost of fuel is going to continue to rise or we're going to run out of fossil fuels.
Which would bring me to the question, why aren't we using more ethanol to run our cars then? If we've been able to do this for quite a while, and if it is much more environmentally friendly.
Well, I would say that for reasons we can discuss, I think it's simple to say that as a society in the 70s and 80s, we were deciding to develop these activities from a research platform. And somewhere down the road, the decision makers decided not to go down that road. We were deciding to diversify our liquid transportation fuel mix when the price of gas was going up. The price of a barrel of fuel then went down to $20 a barrel, and literally that's when research funding in this area dropped again.
So it's really crisis-driven.
It's economic marketplace pressure-driven and crisis-driven. Clearly today we have other issues that are driving this that are not economic. We have geopolitical and you know, various energy policy issues that are not my area. But it's that's another part of the crisis.
Now, how would an ethanol plant actually be – what would it use for fuel? Just to create the ethanol, does it not take
today,
some petroleum product?
That's correct. And so, you know, that gets back to your other question of how do we compare the energy inputs and outputs of fossil fuels – and that could be oil, natural gas, or coal, with the energy inputs and outputs of ethanol. My answer to that is if you look at the analyses where all inputs and outputs are analyzed, they are neutral. There are a lot of reports out there where ethanol comes in as the weak sibling in the system, but those comparisons forget the following things. They forget how much energy it took to create the fossil fuels that are in the ground.
Well, do we care about that, though?
How much energy it takes to get them out of the ground. How many barrels of fuel do we burn to get a barrel of fuel out? In the old days, at the turn of the last century, we were investing about one barrel of fuel to get 100 out. Now we're down to 1 in 10. Okay, the sources of fuel that we have left are very hard to get at. There are analyses out there that say biofuels and ethanol doesn't stack up, but some of those analyses, in my opinion, are comparing apples and oranges because they're not looking at the inputs and the outputs in a fair way.
And if we look at oil sands and shale oil, those, I gather, take at least twice as much oil to get out as you would get out?
I really don't know what the technology, the cost benefit is for them, but those are going to have large environmental negatives in terms of
mining.
Particulates and strip mining and social practices and you know the environmental effects are global warming. We tend to think about that a lot and talk about it, and it's legitimate. If we go to a technology that starts to put more particulates and adverse things in the atmosphere and in the water, it's going to have a trickle-down effect on healthcare costs. I've seen remarks by the head of the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta who has said the largest impact on the cost of healthcare in the next 25 years will be dependent on how we solve the energy problem.
Wow. Mm. So it becomes at least triply important.
That's right.
We've been talking mostly about ethanol, but we're going to turn to talking about the next generation of biofuels and other sources of energy when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Timothy Donahue, and we're talking about biofuels, particularly what will be the next biofuel. Before we talk about biofuels, though, what's wrong with some of those other fuels in terms of advanced technology, fossil fuels, or perhaps more realistically, solar power, nuclear power, wind power?
I think there's advantages to every one of those in a variety of sectors. You know, as a homeowner, I've signed on with MG&E and I'm getting all of my electricity from solar. And I think that's a great program, and I think we should be doing more of that, because that, I think, respects what I said early on, and that is diversifying the energy grid. We're where we are now because we rely heavily on one source of energy. I think there are excellent examples and excellent reasons for why we should be looking to diversify into those other areas, solar and wind. What we're really talking about in the biofuels game in the Great Lakes Center is helping the liquid transportation fuel problem. And an argument could be made that we should be thinking about a day when cars and vehicles and trucks are going to be driven on batteries or on hydrogen or on
right.
other fuels.
Mm-hmm.
And those are excellent conversations to have. What I would say, either to use your words, we're in a crisis or we're in an urgent situation. And we're trying to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels in cars rapidly. And from where I sit, there's a huge infrastructure that's built up in the worldwide automotive industry and in the worldwide fuel industry that supports the automotive industry that's based on liquid transportation fuels.
So true.
And that's something that hasn't changed much in 100 years since Henry Ford, you know, came out with the Model A. There's a quote that I have that I use in one of my slides that shows a picture of Henry. And he actually, at the turn of the century, promoted the idea that we should be running cars on ethanol in the U.S.
Oh, really?
And not on fossil fuels. So we're going back to the old days. I think for all sorts of reasons, infrastructure, jobs, capitalization, pipeline issues, the automotive industry is not ever going to be as nimble as the record industry. In my lifetime, I've gone through listening to 78s, to 8-tracks, to cassettes, to CDs.
We'll forget the LPs.
To Blu-rays, right? Mm-hmm. I haven't seen cars run that different. And I don't think we're going to see, whether it's the Japanese or the U.S. or any automakers, coming up with experimental platforms to run engines on and then having the petrochemical or the oil industry, which currently provides the fuel to run those, come up with a smorgasbord of fueling stations that are going to provide the fuel to run those cars. So I think there's going to need to be a dwell time until a good technology is there for transportation fuels before society globally decides to shift from what we're doing now to something else.
So it's not just a matter of developing this great fuel. It's a matter of developing fuel stations to replace gas stations.
It's a matter of retooling all the auto plants in the U.S., Janesville, everywhere. It's a matter of building the infrastructure to take that fuel and put it in pipelines and then building fueling stations all over the U.S. that would accommodate those, but also realizing that at least when I talk to the people in Detroit, the average homeowner buys a car and keeps it for 8 to 10 years. So if they come out with this new technology in 2009, some of us in this room might still have a car that they bought in 2008 that they're not going to turn over for 7 years. So where are we going to get that fuel as we ramp up doing technology one and ramp down doing technology two? It was easier for me to buy a cassette player and put my turntable away than it is to think about replacing my car every 2 years if we change technology that rapidly.
Well, if we're working on ways to produce things like ethanol or variants of ethanol, wouldn't almost any plant have the capability of being broken down and used in some form?
That's correct. The issue is not to continue to do today's technology, but as a lead-in to develop technology to take the common materials in plants and convert them into those sugars that can then be changed and fermented into ethanol or other fuels. And that's actually what the DOE has tried to catalyze by funding these three bioenergy research centers. So what we're charged to do is to crack the so-called cellulose code, because all plants make sugars and put them into a polymer called cellulose, whether it's corn, whether it's grasses, whether it's trees. Now, that polymer is different than the starch polymer I've talked about before. That polymer is recalcitrant to degradation. It's difficult to break down into sugars. To give you an example that most of us will understand, that cellulose polymer is a fiber, and that's the fiber from a cotton plant that goes into your cotton shirts. You see every day how recalcitrant that cotton fiber is.
How tough.
Not only when you put the shirt on and it doesn't rip, but when you put it in the washing machine and it doesn't dissolve. And it doesn't dissolve whether you do it on hot water or cold water. And it doesn't dissolve whether you add bleach, which is a strong basic chemical. So our job is to figure out how to extract the sugars from that cellulose fiber. And then once we get the sugars, there are existing technologies that can be used to make those sugars into ethanol and can be made even more efficient with the types of R&D that are going on in the three centers.
Why was, indeed, if it was, why was corn the first then for massive ethanol use? So was it just easier to break down?
It's just easier to get the starch and convert it into sugar. That was existing technology. That's how we get all the sugar that goes in your sugar bowl.
And where do you see some of the biggest hope in terms of other plants, other products?
To a first approximation, all cellulose is created equal. Whether it's cellulose in a tree or cellulose in a prairie grass or switchgrass or cellulose in the stalk of a corn plant. Corn stover. So if we can figure out the basic lock and key mechanism to understand how to degrade that polymer into sugar, that's going to lead to rapid advances, because once we do that, we have sugars that we know how to process. There are still technical hurdles in dealing with that sugar, because the sugar that will come from cellulose is not chemically pure. It's not a single molecule like the sugar in your sugar bowl. It's a mixture of sugars. And then we need to figure out how to ferment complex mixtures of sugars. When we make wine or beer, we do it all from one sugar. We know how to do that very well. The early advances are going to be cracking the cellulose code to release the sugars, then figuring out chemically and microbially how to take that mixture of sugars, a malt or a liquor, and convert it into fuels.
And the advantage of that would be then if you could use more than one kind of plant, one kind of vegetation for your ethanol, that you wouldn't have to replant the whole country. You could sort of work with the plant that's predominant in any given part of the country.
From a regional and economic perspective, it means that every state in the country that has excess plant biomass on their land can begin to think about being energy sufficient. They don't all have to be huge importers of oil. So this state imports billions of dollars of energy every year. If we can crack the cellulose code in Wisconsin, we can generate energy from forestry material up north, from grasses in the middle of the state, and from corn stalks, or corn stover, down in the Madison and southwest part of the state. So that's good for the state's economy, because they're not pumping money out to buy it from somewhere else, and because it creates jobs.
And how far away do you think we are from cracking that cellulose code?
I think there are going to be incremental changes at different rates in different parts of the process. I think there are going to be rapid changes with the kind of funding and the kind of technology we can bring to the table in figuring out how to release cellulose from existing agricultural or prairie crops in 2 to 3 years. I really do believe that, because with the people that we have in these three centers and the types of analyses that we can now do with the major funding that we have, I think we can really crack that fast. Then other things that are going to come online are better chemical and microbial systems to convert that mixture of sugars maybe just into ethanol. Maybe we're still going to be putting ethanol into fuel tanks, but we're going to be using plant material that's not part of the food chain. And we're going to be using acres of land that don't need to be competing with acres of land that are currently used for food. If we can do this up north from forestry material, we're not asking for more corn to be planted. If we can do it from native prairie lands, it should be recycled and harvested every year anyway to allow rebirth. We can do it without really changing agricultural practices. I think the next thing that will come online are these improved practices of making fuels and making fuels other than ethanol. Maybe we can make better fuels that don't need to be purified as much. They purify themselves. So there's a different energy balance in making things that don't need to be distilled out of the fermenter like ethanol does. I think a little further down the road, 7 to 10 to 15 years, we will figure out how to breed plants so that they have cellulose that's easier to crack.
And then making it convenient from the get-go.
That's right, making it convenient from the get-go. We will figure out how to, if we're successful, breed plants that not only make softer cellulose, but accumulate hydrocarbons in all of their tissue.
Oh, so they're better fuel as well, as easier
to
get to.
That's right. So that we could actually literally just squeeze the oil right out of a leaf and put it into your fuel tank. That's a simplification, but that's where we want to go.
And right now, without any sort of genetic mutation in the plants, if you just took an acre of prairie grass, how much fuel could you produce? I don't get any sense for how much grass it would take.
An infinitesimally small amount, because we don't know how to crack the cellulose.
But if we did?
If we did, we could get thousands of gallons per acre.
Wow.
So it's efficient.
The amount of sugar that's there is enormous. There are 1 billion tons of plant biomass generated in this country every year, none of which... The cellulose from that, none of which goes into the energy grid. We have an enormous feedstock and reserve of sugar that's out there. It's part of normal agricultural practices, if it's corn stover, normal forestry practices, or just normal letting Mother Nature do what she does best, and that is grow prairie land. That if we could harvest that and recycle it and put it into the energy grid, we would be able to reduce our fossil fuel use in liquid transportation fuels by 30%. That's what that feedstock can do for us.
Tell us about Brazil. We hear occasionally about how they have taken such radical measures and using sugarcane.
What Brazil has decided to do as a society is to put more ethanol in their gas tank than we do in the U.S. So in the U.S. right now, on average, it's a little less than 10% in your gas tank, unless you pull up to a station that advertises they sell ethanol-free fuel. Those are still available in Wisconsin. By comparison, Brazil has decided as a country to run their automotive industry on fuel that has 85% ethanol in it. That's why it's called E85. And you'll see some of that in the U.S., but in order to do that, they've had to invest an enormous amount politically and socially and environmentally to increase the production of sugar that can be used to generate ethanol.
So what are they doing, chopping down the rainforest
They've done it with government policies and price support to promote the development of a larger sugarcane industry. They've done it by using those policies to promote the conversion of rainforest and land that were used for other agricultural uses into sugarcane plantations. Those are not the types of decisions that we've made in the U.S.
Because that rainforest is taking a lot of carbon dioxide out of the air, and if you cut down the rainforest, then you're not really helping the atmosphere because you're not helping the atmosphere.
You're changing water table and water quality issues. You're affecting environmental and habitat issues for animals and plants and birds and insects. And I'm a microbiologist. Usually no one cares about the microbes that live in the soil. But the microbes that live in the soil, you're changing the whole geochemistry of the environment.
Well, speaking of the microbes that live in the soil, what about the use of landfill and dumping, you know, things that are waste products to use that to produce fuel? What kind of efforts are underway?
Well, there are not large federally funded efforts like those in these bioenergy centers to do that. Again, the bioenergy centers were funded to make a significant impact on the liquid transportation fuel. Liquid transportation fuels are about a third of the energy grid in the U.S. And so the DOE decided to put a large amount of money into helping to solve one of the largest problems. But there are resident technologies out there that need to be supported, in my opinion, to allow a farmer to take his animal waste and seed that animal waste and then something equivalent to a compost heap that has microbes in it that can be used to generate fuels. Those could be oils or diesel. Those could be hydrogen, which could be captured and burned, or methane. There are methane digesters on farms in the state, a lot of them right now, and that activity could be scaled up and optimized. Or even electricity. We have technology in the lab where if we generate hydrogen, we can then oxidize it on site and generate electricity. And that could work from the homeowner in Milwaukee to the farmer to the Madison wastewater treatment plant to a cheese company who has waste organics that they now pay a tax to send to the wastewater treatment plant. All of those renewable carbon units, whether it's animal waste or cheese processing whey or sawdust, could be converted into energy to help decrease the amount that we need to buy from the power companies. And the power companies, I think, are very receptive to this, or I know they are from conversations that I've had, whether it's putting solar panels on your house or thinking about this technology. They are beginning to put in place plans where if you develop technologies like this and you're generating more energy on site than your home can use, they will buy it from you and add it to their grid so that they don't have to build another power plant. This is all part of the bartering system that was started in the 80s with energy credits and environmental credits that I think have driven a lot of the change in the energy landscape. And I think down the road, the types of things that you're asking about are going to lead to policies that deal with it from an energy but also from a carbon credit basis, that these technologies will be more carbon neutral. And people who are doing things that are carbon positive or carbon neutral will get a benefit from it that they can sell to an industry that just can't do that yet.
Do you have a sense of what role the petroleum industry is playing in this research or what their attitude is toward it?
Well, on one hand, there's a lot of interest in the petroleum industry to do this. I'll give you some striking examples. The Bioenergy Center at Madison is funded to the tune of $25 million a year for the next 5 years. And there are three of these. So that means the Department of Energy has invested $75 million this year in the establishment of these three centers. BP, a worldwide petroleum industry, has set up its own bioenergy research center in California to the tune of $50 million a year for 10 years. So they have doubled the amount of funding per year compared to my center, and they've made a commitment to do it for twice as long. So that's $500 million. The oil producers are also investing large amounts in biofuels technology. The Middle East is throwing a lot of money at universities with large programs, building them on site to investigate biofuels. So this could be a waste of time, or it could be that people in the business think it's something that's on the horizon. Locally in town, there's a company called Virent which is in the biofuels business that grew out of the university, that just signed a major contract with another oil company to scale up their technology from the bench scale to a real pilot scale to see how much fuel additive they could make per day as a way of seeing how this would really fit into a petroleum liquid transportation fuel. So I think they see it's on the horizon. I think there are reasons why we should go down this road. And I think they're positioning themselves to move into this market if the technology is there because it makes business sense for them.
Well, in a sense, it makes it more practical for everybody if you have this kind of infrastructure already in place to install it around the country.
We're going to look at some final thoughts about the next generation of biofuels in a moment when we return with University of the Year. The imperative of developing new carbon-neutral forms of energy has never been clearer or more compelling. At its heart, the challenge is a scientific one. Substantial reductions in fossil fuel consumption will require more than incremental improvements in our current technologies. It will require transformational discoveries and breakthroughs in basic science that fundamentally change the rules of the game. That is the mission of the three Department of Energy Bioenergy Research Centers. That's a statement by Raymond Auerbach, the Undersecretary for Science at the U.S. Department of Energy. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland and our guest, Tim Donahue. We're talking about the next generation of biofuels. It's kind of exciting that Madison is one of the three centers that's being funded to explore new biofuels. Can you say something about these three centers and what the one in Madison and Michigan is doing?
Sure. We're very, very excited to be named as one of these three centers. We are the home institution. The other two home institutions are national labs. The other two centers are located at Lawrence Berkeley Lab in the San Francisco Bay Area, and they have partnerships with Sandia Lab, Lawrence Livermore National Lab, and University of California, Davis, and some biotech companies in the Bay Area. The second center has a home institution at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and they have partnerships at the Oak Ridge National Lab, and they have partnerships with the National Renewable Energy Lab in Boulder, Colorado, as well as academic partnerships with the University of Georgia, Georgia Tech, and then some partnerships with biotech companies in the biofuels arena scattered throughout the East Coast. Our center has a very Midwest focus, which is why we're called the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. We are the home of the center. We have a major partnership with our colleagues at Michigan State University in East Lansing. We have collaborators at Iowa State, Illinois State University, University of Florida, the DOE National Labs at Richland, Washington, and actually at Oak Ridge. We have some people working with our center that are not part of the Oak Ridge Center. And we have a local partnership in Middleton, Wisconsin, with a biotech company called Lucigen.
And what are you the most proud of about this particular center in terms of what you're working on?
We're proud in Wisconsin for a lot of reasons. We won this center in a very stiff competition that was science-based. And so we're proud of the fact that the review team and the agency have looked at our science portfolio and given us the right to spend $25 million of taxpayer money a year. It's not something that happens a lot. It's the largest single grant UW-Madison has ever won in its history. We won it in a science-based competition, but we're enormously proud of the other parts of the team that we put together to win this. We had a huge amount of support from the state, starting at the governor's office, going down through cabinet members, and really support in a bipartisan way from people in a state government. This is an issue that resonates with a large group of people for a variety of different reasons. We've had a huge amount of support from the technology transfer and licensing arm of the university. Carl Gabranson and his staff in the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation has been critical in putting together a technology transfer team that will function as a virtual team, just like the center does, because there are representatives from the patent offices from all of those partner institutions that are already ready to take our technology from the lab and the field to the patent office and bring it to the marketplace in a way that literally, to my knowledge, has never been done before, to get an agreement from all these institutions up front that there were going to be general principles that wanted to get this technology out there fast. We've already brought technology to Wharf that I can't talk about yet. But I think it just is a sign that there's going to be a faucet that opens. It's going to start as a trickle, but then it's really going to come out fast. It's going to bring companies to the states, to the region, bring technology, bring resources, and really establish Wisconsin as being a ground zero in a positive way in this field as we move forward. You know, as someone who's been here 20 years, I never worked in anything like this before. It's been an enormous amount of pride to see all the companies and the state and the university, from my dean in the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences, Molly John, all the way up through the central administration in Bascom that helped us get this grant out the door and helped us win it. It was really a true Wisconsin idea, team effort to put the right people together to get technology that we're going to then bring to the people and help reform how the state functions in the next 50 to 100 years.
This would include patents for less recalcitrant forms of corn and switchgrass?
It would include patents for less recalcitrant forms of corn and switchgrass. It would include patents for forms of plants that generate hydrocarbons in all their tissues. It would include patents for how we take plants apart to sugars, how we develop new chemical or microbial systems to convert that sugar mixture into fuels. It could include patents on software packages or ways of monitoring environmental impacts of new biomass crops in the field so that we're building a new technology that's more sustainable.
Are you looking at other parts of the world besides Brazil in terms of seeing what's being done either well or not so well?
There's a part of the center that's very focused on our sustainability area. It's very focused on figuring out how agricultural practices in the Midwest would be affected by new biomass technologies. And that includes putting crops in the ground this summer in Michigan at the Kellogg Biological Station and at the Arlington Experimental Station in Wisconsin as two sister sites, to see what the carbon footprint, water quality, microbial, soil ecology, bird migration, animal migration impacts are of planting corn versus prairie land versus trees, et cetera, et cetera. And take the data from those small stands and try to generate reasonable models for what would happen if you go from an acre to 100,000 acres. So those are very regional, and they respect what we're going to do in the Midwest. But part of what we're learning in the environmental part of this is that the carbon footprint, the CO2 that's released, doesn't stay in Wisconsin. It doesn't stay in the Midwest. We are sharing carbon that comes from activities in Brazil or in the Far East. There, instead of planting sugarcane, they're planting a lot more acres in Jatropha because it accumulates oil. So there's a part of the sustainability aspects of the center that are taking global satellite data and beginning to try and model where the carbon's coming from, how it's moving, how as we begin in this country to have more of the carbon from plant biomass go into the energy grid, how that practice is going to affect carbon footprints, not only in Wisconsin, but across the border and off to our friends in Canada, but as it goes over the ocean and around the world. So there's a clear global aspect to what we're doing when you realize that our activities don't have geographical boundaries associated with them. Just like we worry about the spread of viruses coming into the country and out of the country on planes, we have to worry about how these activities are going to affect our neighbors and how are our activities are going to be affected by what our neighbors are doing when we look at the carbon footprint and the energy grid.
Well, I can see that it could get very complicated and almost to the point of paralysis if you thought about every ramification of planting switchgrass where the corn is. It could really, if you tried to minimize every impact, stop you from accomplishing anything. Somewhere along the line, you're going to have to say, let's just do it.
I'm going to hide behind the wall of being an egghead academic for a minute and say that what we're focusing on doing is generating scientific data on these issues and using the best techniques that we have and the best ways to predict how a plant will behave if we do something or how carbon footprints will behave if we do something. From that data, then society needs to make decisions. That's where policy comes in. Just like 30 years ago, we decided to put ethanol in the gas tanks for carbon emissions policies, society is going to need to make decisions on what they're most interested in as they look at the trade-offs of different practices. There's a Pollyanna part of me that believes this is all going to be easy and obvious what we do. But from a realistic part, there's going to be difficult decisions down the road that we're going to need to make on all of these parts of the biomass and the energy grid. And our job right now is to do the basic fundamental science and give the policymakers and the economists the best data we can so that we can be part of the dialogue to help society frame the decision-making processes.
You're worrying about recalcitrant plants and not recalcitrant people.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, thanks for being with us for this hour, and it sounds like you'll have to come back because this is developing so quickly and will have such an obvious effect fairly soon.
Well, I was really happy to be here, and I want to thank you both for inviting me. I'd love to come back. We view this as like setting off on a path to go to the moon, and hopefully we're going to have something to say soon, and I'd love to come back and talk about it.
We'll look forward to that. Our guest has been Tim Donahue, and I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.